I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, what did you do when you finished high school? Some of us tried traveling. Some of us went to college. Some of us went to work. When Christopher Paolini finished high school, he also went to work on a novel. And this is where the story of the young fantasy writer himself challenges the imagination. You see, Christopher was homeschooled and finished high school when he was 15. The book was done by the time he was 17. Christopher's parents knew that the book, Aragon, was good. They had it printed by a self-publishing firm, and the family set to work selling it. Well, at one point, a year or so later, the writer, Carl Hyacin, came across a copy, recommended it to his own publishing firm, and within short order, Aragon was rivaling Harry Potter for sales. This hour, we'll talk with Christopher Paolini about his book. We're inviting you to join us. Are you ready for a book by a teenage writer? Are you a convert to the recent passion for fantasy writing? And what is it about fantasy that appeals today? What is it that has adults and youngsters reading these books? Is it a refuge from reality, or is it just a different way of looking at the world? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from a studio in the Public Library in Bozeman, Montana, the author of Aragon, Christopher Paolini. Thanks a lot for joining us, Christopher.
Thank you for having me.
Help me a bit with the timeline here. I kind of tripped through it quickly there. You wrote the book, if I understand it, in 1 year. You got the first draft done in 1 year. Was it ready to go at that point?
No. Yeah, you're correct. I finished the first draft in the first year, and at the end of that year, I sat down and read it through for the first time. And I was, you know, I was pretty excited. I get to read my own book for the first time.
And?
It was awful. It was truly horrendous. The story was there, but the writing itself needed help, and I could tell that by looking at the book. So I decided to fix everything that I could, and I spent a second year and rewrote the book, keeping the story but fleshing out the dialogue and the characters and the descriptions.
Right.
And at the end of the second year, that's when I finally handed the manuscript over to my parents, neither of which had actually seen the book until that point.
Now, both of them teachers, both of them writers. What was their reaction?
Well, my father, for one, does not read fantasy. So his reaction was one of guarded skepticism at first. But once he actually read the book, he became very enthusiastic about the story, as did my mom. And the two of them decided that the book was good enough to put the family business behind, or put the whole family behind it and make it the family business, which was really an extraordinary risk. But, you know, they were willing to work on it with me, and it's turned out for the best, thankfully.
Do you remember when you first got your first copy of the self-published Aragon back from the printer, what it was like to hold that book?
Oh, yes. Well, we'd wrapped up the book in winter of 99 and winter of 2000 and shipped the book off to the printer. And 2 weeks later, we got the first proof copy. And if you've spent 3 years working on nothing but one thing, that thing becomes you. And seeing Aragon for the first time was... It's actually hard to put it into words. It was like holding a piece of my own identity. It was an extraordinary feeling.
Was it a lonely moment, or was it something that you were able to share with your sister and your mom and dad?
Oh, it was a moment of triumph for the family and of extreme joy for me. And again, seeing all that work finally coming to fruition is something that I've never forgotten, and I doubt I ever will. The problem was, as we quickly realized, was that no one outside of the family knew about the book. And so my mom suggested that I start traveling around and going to local schools and libraries and doing presentations about the book and about writing and fantasy.
What did you think of that idea?
Well, I was a little nervous about it at first. I hadn't done any public speaking, and I wasn't sure how I would feel walking out in front of a bunch of people. But, you know, again, I'd spent so long working on the book that I wanted people to read it, and I was willing to do what I had to so that people could read it.
That includes dressing up in some funny clothes?
Yes, that was also my mom's idea. She suggested that I go in medieval costume to get attention, and, you know, I do what my mommy tells me to.
So do I.
And the first few presentations went so well that we started going to other cities and then other states, and before we knew it, we were on the road for almost all.
Oh, looks like we may have lost our connection to Bozeman. Are you, Christopher, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, just had a little hiccup on the line. Sorry, we lost you. So you were going to all sorts of states. Were these large audiences that you were appearing before?
I did it depended on how many people we were able to get. I did presentations from as small of audiences as one people and as large as 500, 600, 700 people at once. And usually I ended up going into public schools because the kids were there, you know, they weren't going anywhere. They had to listen to me. But I also felt that I was able to do something for them by talking about reading and writing and hopefully inspiring them. And also the teachers and the librarians, they just rolled out the red carpet. They went above and beyond the call of duty in helping spread the word about the book.
Right.
And getting the kids interested in it and helping Aragon. If it weren't for them, I certainly wouldn't be talking to you right now.
But we know that the book has been a success since Knopf got its hands onto it. But at that point, when you were doing this traveling, were you actually selling copies of the book? Like, was it looking like you were going to make this a family business success story even at that point?
We didn't have a choice at that point. We bet the farm on it, so to speak. if the book had taken another few months to start making a profit, we were going to have to sell the house, move to a city, and get jobs. It came that close.
A little scary for people who are well settled in Paradise Valley, Montana.
But it got to the point, it got to the point where we literally could not fulfill the orders. We were getting so many orders, it was too much for us. So it was perfect when Knopf stepped in. But I ended up doing over 135 events across the country. And I met some incredible people along the way. I met a woman who loved Aragon so much, she named her pet tarantula after the dragon, Saphira, in the book. And you see this thing, it's this big hairy spider. You know, here's Saphira.
Now here you are 4 years later. What is that? I mean, it's winter 2000, we're winter 2004 here. Are you tired of talking about the book?
No. I had to think about that for a second, but no. Again, you know, I've put so much work into the book, and I'm in the middle of the second book right now. At this point is really my life, and after everything the fans have done to support the book and support me, I'm only more than happy to talk about it.
Now, Aragon, I'm not going to give away too much, but Aragon is the hero here who discovers the magic stone, which turns out to be a dragon's egg, and it leads him off into some pretty exciting adventures using the geography of an imaginary land and imaginary language and stuff like that. I wonder, Christopher, if I can just get you to read for us that passage in the book where Aragon and Saphira first really link up as rider and dragon rider. Do you know the place that I'm referring to?
Yes, this is fairly early in the book. This is one of the first few times when Aragon and Saphira are flying together. And this has always been a favorite part in the book for me. For anyone who's interested, it's on page 162. Hope you enjoy it. Although Aragon's stomach lurched with every wobble, he began to enjoy himself. He relaxed his arms a bit and stretched his neck back, taking in the scenery. Saphira let him enjoy the sights a while, then said, "Let me show you what flying is really like." "How?" he asked. "Relax and do not be afraid," she said. Her mind tugged at his, pulling him away from his body. Aragon fought for a moment, then surrendered control. His vision blurred, and he found himself looking through Saphira's eyes. Everything was distorted. Colors had weird, exotic tints. Blues were more prominent now, while greens and reds were subdued. Aragon tried to turn his head and body, but could not. He felt like a ghost who had slipped out of the ether. Pure joy radiated from Saphira as she climbed into the sky. She loved this freedom to go anywhere. When they were high above the ground, she looked back at Aragon. He saw himself as she did, hanging on to her with a blank look. He could feel her body strain against the air, using updrafts to rise. All her muscles were like his own. He felt her tail swinging through the air like a giant rudder to correct her course. It surprised him how much she depended on it. Their connection grew stronger until there was no distinction between their identities. They clasped their wings together and dived straight down like a spear thrown from on high. No terror of falling touched Aragorn, engulfed as he was in Saphira's exhilaration. The air rushed past their face, their tail whipped in the air, and their joined minds reveled in the experience. Even as they plummeted toward the ground, there was no fear of collision. They snapped open their wings at just the right moment, pulling out of the dive with their combined strength. Slanting toward the sky, they shot up and continued back over into a giant loop. As they leveled out, their minds began to diverge, becoming distinct personalities again. For a split second, Aragorn felt both his body and Saphira's. Then his vision blurred, and he again sat on her back. He gasped and collapsed in the saddle. It was minutes before his heart had stopped hammering and his breathing calmed. Once he had recovered, he exclaimed, "That was incredible! How can you bear to land when you enjoy flying so much?" "I must eat," she said with some amusement. "But I am glad that you took pleasure in it." "Those are spare words for such an experience. I'm sorry I haven't flown with you more. I never thought it could be like that. Do you always see so much blue?" "It is the way I am." "We will fly together more often now?" "Yes. Every chance we get."
That's the voice of Christopher Paolini reading from his book, Aragorn, about the encounter between Aragorn and Saphira, the dragon. It's clear you still can breathe some life into that one. It's fun to listen to you read, Christopher.
Thank you.
Just a quick question, because we're going to go to break in a moment. I'm just wondering whether or not the time that you've spent in Alaska and Montana, those big open spaces of this country, was part of what sort of fueled your imagination as a fantasy writer.
I certainly think so. Actually, not so much big open places, but mountains. Always mountains. I've pretty much grown up along mountains all my life. In fact, for the past 13, 14 years, I've lived right along the Beartooth Mountain Range here in Montana. And seeing those peaks outside my window every morning and being able to hike up in the mountains and walk out and see the sunsets gilding the glaciers and the snow and the granite, I consider myself as much of a nature writer as a fantasy writer. Being able to describe the beauty of the world around us is one of the joys of writing for me, and for many fantasy writers as well, I think.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, that's the number for you to join my conversation with Christopher Paolini as we talk about his new book, Aragorn, and we'll talk more about the fantasy genre and what's ahead for Christopher when we come back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Christopher Paolini. He is author of a book called Aragorn. It's his first book. He wrote the book when he was, started writing the book when he was 15 years old. And Christopher, you're now what, just 20?
I just turned 20 in November, yes.
Okay. And let's bring Brian Atterbury into the conversation with us. Brian is an English professor at Idaho State University, has written a number of books exploring fantasy, fiction, among them the fantasy tradition in American literature. He's also co-editor of the Norton Anthology of Science Fiction Writing, and Brian's been listening along with the rest of us. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hello, and hello, Christopher.
Great to talk with you.
Brian, you're a little bit like me, because if I'm not mistaken, your daughter read Aragorn first. She liked it, gave you something of a book report, right?
She spotted it on the bookstore shelves and requested it for Christmas, but I actually grabbed it away before she had a chance to read it. So she hasn't yet. She's been reading Garth Nix lately, and this is next on her list.
Okay, so you've still got your thumbprint on it. Tell us, as a student and a professor of fantasy, where it fits, what you think.
Well, I've been thinking about a lot of the questions involved with it. I think it's a remarkable book for any writer, especially a young one, but then fantasy seems to draw out writers at a fairly young age. I'm thinking of people like the Brontes, who concocted a whole fantasy world in their nursery and wrote elaborate stories, or Tolkien, who started composing the kind of mythos behind The Lord of the Rings when he was still a teenager. So it's maybe something that goes along with the kind of intensity of imagination that is part of adolescence.
Christopher, what do you think? Because I mean, I know in so much of what I have read about the book that there isn't a writer or a reviewer who doesn't make note of the fact that you did this when you were so young. Are you a little bit tired of that part of your story?
No, I mean, it'll pass before long, so I'll enjoy it while it lasts.
Do you think Brian's put his finger on something when he talks about the intensity of imagination?
I do. I know that I was first introduced to fantasy when I was maybe 12, 13, 11 or 12. I read my first fantasy book, The Ruby Knight by David Eddings, and it hit me at exactly the right moment. I was just entering, my teenage years, mm-hmm. and I hit this fantasy, and yeah, I guess you could say I became obsessed with it. It fit exactly with, you know, the daydreams I was having, with the things I wanted to do. And you're right. I mean, it attracts an intensity of imagination. I think that's a very, very good phrase. And the more you read a fantasy, the more you become acquainted with the more out-of-the-way writers, such as Mervyn Peake, who did the Gormenghast trilogy, mm-hmm. or E.R. Edison, who did The Worm Ouroboros, or even His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. These are very intense works.
And these are works that I'm not as familiar with, the fantasy writers. But I think, Brian, these writers are coming back into public attention, are they not?
Yeah, I think what's happened is the grown-ups were a little slow catching on, and the kids knew all along that this is where a lot of the really best stories have always been. And so you've got parents and children sharing the experience now, and it's coming from the younger set, the exploration of the fantasy world.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island now. Stephen's going to join the conversation. Stephen, thanks for calling.
Hi, yes, good morning. It's nice to be with you. I'd like to make a couple of comments, if I may. And first of all, Christopher, I'd like to say you're absolutely right about Pullman's work. I think that The Golden Compass is a wonderful novel. And I've recently taught Suzanne Cooper's The Dark is Rising in a course. I'm a first-year English teacher in a public school here. The reason that I think that these materials are appealing to young readers are because of these archetypes, you know, the phrase made famous by Carl Jung, these situations and characters that evoke universal responses, these things that are almost instantly recognizable, the mentor figure, the hero, the outcast, and situations like the journey, the initiation, or the quest. And I think another thing to mention, too, is if we can talk about Tolkien for a moment, of course, his material is well known now, popularized by film and graphic novels and video games as well. But the origins of his work come from Scandinavian mythology, Celtic mythology, Old English poetry. Anyone that's ever read Beowulf should know that The Hobbit has the material that's directly lifted from it, Smaug being that. The dragon in Lonely Mountain is the dragon in Beowulf in the stone barrow lofty. It's identical. It's amazing that it is.
Christopher, these are some of your areas of inspiration as well, are they not?
Well, I completely agree, and I'm glad you brought it up because you're right. Nothing is ever created in a vacuum. And in fact, I was going through a dictionary of Old Norse that I acquired online recently, and the word Gandalf came up as a Norse name as for a dwarf. Frodo is also an Old Norse word. I believe it means intelligent or brilliant or something like that, along those lines.
What about Brisinger? That's one of your words. Where does that come from?
That's right. Well, my elf language, which is referred to as the ancient language within the book, is based almost entirely on Old Norse. I thought it gave the book a nice depth and feel. And Brisinger is a rare Old Norse word for fire.
Which is, in fact, what happens whenever somebody says the word.
Well, assuming you can use it properly, yes.
Brian Atterbury, I don't know whether or not in your studies, fantasy is anything different from other genres. I'm listening to the way that Stephen and Christopher are describing how writers build on the work of other writers. Is that just the same as you'd see it in the romance genre or the spy novel genre?
I think it's a different set of sources. Absolutely, writers build on other writers and genres develop as a kind of dialogue among writers. But the sources for the fantasy almost all go back to folk traditions. Some of the Scandinavian myths that Stephen mentioned, the legends from all around the world, fairy tales, ballads, and fantasy writers are pretty savvy about these things. Most mm-hmm. of the fantasy writers I know are very well read in world mythologies and folk traditions and even anthropology. And I think maybe I would follow up something Stephen said about the archetypes, that I think that the fantasies do appeal to something pretty fundamental in our psychology, and Jung had a good way of describing that with his archetypal theory. But I think what some of the contemporary fantasy writers are starting to do is to make use of those and at the same time critique them, because archetypes like the hero may be powerful, but they've also got some kind of dangerous implications that have been explored by writers like Gene Wolfe and Ursula Le Guin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would also add, I like to say that for me, I consider fantasy the oldest form of fiction in the world. If you go back to ancient Greece, they're talking about snake-haired women and one-eyed giants. It's fantasy. And writing about it allows you to deal with themes that would maybe even be absurd or out of place in other fiction, but fit perfectly with an imagined world.
Yeah, when you consider that these traditional stories had to be passed along from person to person, they predate writing, nothing will get passed along for generations unless it appeals to the audience. So these have been honed down so that they are the best stories in many ways. And I think the modern fantasy writers have just figured out some ways to develop new ideas based on those things.
And Christopher, when you're putting together a fantasy book today, do you say, right, I can use a dragon rider from here, and I can use, you know, a werecat from here, but how much do I have to contribute before someone says, oh, it's just a pastiche of other people's stuff?
You know, I don't even think about it in those terms. I write what feels to me the way a fantasy story should read.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I tried to write a book that I would enjoy reading using all the elements that I had enjoyed from other fantasy books, plus the things that I thought they hadn't included, and my own interpretations of those elements. So, for example, I have dragon riders, which have certainly been used before, and I have a young hero with a sword. And I have a gigantic, evil, murderous king who rules the land where our hero grows up. And yet, the way the story is told, and especially the relationship between Aragorn and Saphira, mm-hmm. I feel is particularly my own and brings my own a view to the material. And, you know, I had fun writing it, and that was the main thing. I want people to have fun reading the book and to enjoy reading the book. And if they do that, then I've done my job.
It was actually one of the comments of my daughter, who's just your age, who said, I think he had fun writing this book. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Baton Rouge, Louisiana now. And Brent, you're with us. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead, Brent.
Great. I'm out of the truck, so I wouldn't get the bleed over, so I wasn't sure.
Thank you for that.
I, I'm very impressed with how young he is. I know he said that people keep bringing that up, but I think sometimes young people have an advantage because they don't see the barriers in front of them. I'm in my early 40s, and one night I actually was laying there in bed and woke up and had an idea for a book and, in theory, wrote the whole book for I got up that next morning. It was kind of strange. Everything was just flowing to me like I was watching a movie, and then I wanted to try to put it down and see if I could get a writer to be interested in helping me with it, but then you don't know what to do. You know, you don't know the route to take. But my main reason for the call is I was listening to him read, and it's just mesmerizing. The way he does it and puts the feelings into it is the way that he wrote it. So he knows where he wants to, you know, do the high points and the low points. And I just be curious if he would be willing to read the book and then put it onto a CD where you could put it into the and listen with your kids, and the parents could sit on the couch and listen to the book being read to them and enjoy it with their kids.
Have you done an audio tape version, Christopher?
There is an audiobook recording of Aragon, which came out from the Listening Library Company. It was read by Gerard Doyle, so unfortunately I did not get a chance to read it. I would have loved to have read it, but the problem is at this point I don't have the time to do something that intensive. And also I'm not a trained voice actor, and the man who read it, certainly it shows in the way he creates the different characters with the voices, and I was very impressed by what he did. I didn't agree with everything, but I was very impressed by the reading overall.
Okay, well, Brent, I'm going to let you get back in your truck and turn the radio up, and as you're doing that, set Christopher up for another reading, so you get to be taken to a different part of the story. Christopher, what would we be hearing from next? What part of the book are we going to listen to next?
Well, this reading, which I just found here, is from later in the book, when Aragorn and Saphira are inside this gigantic hollow mountain called Farthendur, which is 10 miles across and 10 miles high. And it's later in the story, near the end of the book, so their friendship has deepened. And I think that this reading shows a bit of the sense of wonder and awe that I was going for in the story. So for anyone who's interested, it's on page 428. Without further protest, Aragorn slipped through the jostling group that surrounded Saphira and jumped onto her back. Before she could take off, an old woman stepped forward and grasped Aragorn's foot with a fierce grip. He tried to pull away, but her hand was like an iron talon around his ankle. He could not break her tenacious hold. The burning gray eyes she fixed on him were surrounded by a lifetime's worth of wrinkles. The skin was folded in long creases down her sunken cheeks. A tattered bundle rested in the crook of her left arm. Frightened, Aragorn asked, "What do you want?" The woman tilted her arm, and a cloth fell from the bundle, revealing a baby's face. Hoarse and desperate, she said, "The child has no parents. There is no one to care for her but me, and I am weak. Bless her with your power, Arjit Lam. Bless her for luck." Aragorn looked to Oryk for help, but the dwarf only watched with a guarded expression. The small crowd fell silent, waiting for his response. The woman's eyes were still fastened on him. "Bless her, Arjit Lam. Bless her," she insisted. Aragorn had never blessed anyone. It was not something done lightly in Alagazia, as a blessing could easily go awry and prove to be more curse than boon, especially if it were spoken with ill intent or lack of conviction. "Do I dare take that responsibility?" he wondered. "Bless her, Arjit Lam. Bless her." Suddenly decided, he searched for a phrase or expression to use. Nothing came to mind until, inspired, he thought of the ancient language. This would be a true blessing, spoken with words of power by one of power. He bent down and tugged the glove off his right hand. Laying his palm on the babe's brow, he intoned, Atra gulie un ilien, tauther ono un atra ono, weise skulur fra rauther. The words left him unexpectedly weak, as if he had used magic. He slowly pulled the glove back on and said to the woman, "That is all I can do for her. If any words have the power to forestall tragedy, it will be those." "Thank you, Arjitlam," she whispered, bowing slightly. She started to cover the baby again, but Saphira snorted and twisted until her head loomed over the child. The woman grew rigid, her breath caught in her chest. Saphira lowered her snout and brushed the baby between the eyes with the tip of her nose, then smoothly lifted away. A gasp ran through the crowd, for on the child's forehead, where Saphira had touched her, was a star-shaped patch of skin as white and silvery as Aragon's Gedwe Ignazia. The woman stared at Saphira with a feverish gaze, wordless thanks in her eyes.
Once again, Christopher Paolini reading from his book, Aragon. Can you translate the blessing for us? Can you put that into English for us, Christopher?
If my memory serves, it says, "Let luck and happiness follow you, and may you be shielded from misfortune."
Is it the same blessing that Aragon receives from Brahm?
No, it's not.
It's a different one, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a different one, yes. That reading always gets me every time I do it.
I think it gets us as well. I'm going to let you relax and listen to some music that I know is close to your heart as we get ready for a short break here. A reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Christopher Paolini is my guest. We're talking about his book, Aragon. A little bit of Wagner to take us to the break. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Christopher Paolini, author of the book called Aragon. And Brian Atterbury is also with us. He's an English professor at Idaho State who specializes in fantasy writing. One of his books is called Strategies of Fantasy. Once again, our number, 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to take our next call from Andover, Massachusetts, and Emma is joining us. Emma, thank you for calling.
Hi. Would you recommend trying to write a book?
Do you have a book in your mind, Emma?
Well, I just sort of like to write stories about, sort of short stories about everyday kids.
Can I ask you, Emma, how old you are?
10. I'll be 11 next month.
Christopher, how old were you when you started writing stories?
Oh, just about your age. I wrote all sorts of stories. I wrote poems, I wrote short stories, I tried to write books. I would certainly recommend writing a book, Emma. It's a very enjoyable experience, and you can learn a huge amount from it. I know that for me, writing has become my life, and if you're serious about wanting to write and you want to learn more about it, then there are three things that I would suggest for you. One, write about the things that you enjoy the most, because writing a book is a tough project, and if you write about things that you love, it makes the whole process easier. The other thing would be to learn everything you can about writing. It's difficult, but everything you can about grammar and the technical aspects of writing. That will make editing much less painful. And then the last thing, and this is maybe the most important thing of all, is to find a good editor. Because if someone can tell you what you're doing wrong with your work, then you can make it better. And unless someone is there to tell you what you've done wrong, you won't know. So those three things, find an editor, learn what you can about the technical aspects of writing, and write about what you love the most.
Did you get all that down, Emma?
Yep.
What is it that you love the most?
Well, I like writing about stories sort of about everyday kids because it's an everyday things that could possibly happen. I enjoy reading fantasy stories, but I mostly like reading and writing everyday things.
Well, I think that you'll, Christopher would tell you that he wrote a lot of stories that didn't work. So don't get discouraged, okay?
Innumerable ones. In fact, Aragon is the only one that worked. Out of all the stories I've written, Aragon is the only one that's worked so far. And if I showed you the ones that didn't work, no one would say that I could write. But that's the good writers know to keep that stuff under wraps.
Emma, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Good luck with your writing.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks.
Next to Lincoln, and Carol is joining us. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on with us. How are you?
Hi, I am great. Hi, Dick. Christopher, I have one comment to start out with, is maybe you could do your next audio tape. That was fabulous reading.
Thank you.
What I was going to talk about is, Dick, you had mentioned earlier about sort of the role of fantasy and why it is so compelling, because it's clear to me and to many that it is compelling on many levels. I wanted to comment and just ask both of you your thoughts about this, how it seems that what people can do when they listen and read fantasy is enlarge their own behavioral repertoire of what's available for them to do when they are on their own personal quest in this life. That you sort of read about these heroes and you can borrow from them the kind of throw yourself in a direction and bless someone or do something good that seems beyond you and see that it has good effects. But that these stories, I think, are very healing and enlarging for people.
Christopher, go ahead, Christopher.
A large question there, a large comment. I think that stories like these are important because they can show the way, they can provide examples for people as how we should live our lives honorably and justly. Now, I'm not saying everything needs to be black and white, good and evil, but, you know, how should we act in difficult situations? And fantasy deals with this in many different situations, you know. How do we face death and how do we deal with dishonor or honor? Various different aspects of life. And the great hero stories, if you will, allow people to interpret it in different ways. I think Lord of the Rings is a great example. Almost every reader who reads those books, if you like the books, you find some way to empathize and find your own life reflected in the book. And that's what great writing does. It explains life for the reader.
Yeah, Dick, I have a comment on that people talk about fantasy as escape. Those who don't like it criticize it as escape. But I've always thought of it as a kind of strategic retreat from the world you experience into a world where everything's a little clearer, a little more externalized, because that's what magic does, where you can see things laid out during the time while you're reading the fantasy so that you can see there's evil, there's good, there's the tremendous cost, which is usually involved in acquiring power and doing any good in the world. And then when you finish the book, none of that translates directly, but it all feeds into the imagination, and as Carol said, it enlarges your repertoire of ways of responding to the world.
Okay, but Brian, let me ask you one last question, and that is, how is it that so many hundreds of thousands, millions of people will involve themselves in the way that they do in the complexity of these stories? I think, you know, there are dozens of characters in Christopher's books. There's hundreds in the Tolkien trilogy, and it requires a lot from the reader to, you know, keep in mind what land we're in now, what powers the people there have, what the names of the characters are. What is it in that kind of strategic retreat you're talking about where you're teaching yourself, where the reader says, no, I'm going to do this?
There's a lot of pleasure in it, for one thing. You either like to play the game of fantasy or you don't. And there are people who are not really very good at reading fantasy. Unfortunately, they often mistake that for having superior taste. But I think that children usually can read it that way. They read with tremendous attention. The fantasy writer Diana Wynne Jones talks about the fact that adults sometimes get confused by her plots, but the kids never do, because they pay attention as they read. It may be a matter of having the time to do that, which kids do, but I think there's a certain way of reading that fantasy requires. I think it was Tolkien who said it, you have to pay something extra to read fantasy. And for some people, the rewards are not there.
Brian,
but for those of us who love it, yeah, it's it provides an experience that nothing else, even the movies, can't do.
Thank you so much for being with us on the program today, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Brian Atterbury is an English professor at Idaho State University, author of a couple of books, The Fantasy Tradition in American Literature, Strategies of Fantasy. Christopher, I want to hear you on what it is that you ask of a reader to participate in this kind of fantasy world. It's obviously something you've thought about.
I personally believe, I agree with what he said, that it is a pleasurable experience. Obviously, if it weren't pleasurable, people wouldn't do it in such great numbers. There is a pleasure in finding a world. Tolkien is a good example. He mentioned Diane Wynne Jones. For me, it's Ursula Le Guin, Raymond E. Feist, Mervyn Peake, Philip Pullman. Finding an imaginary world with all these details, and the details are what makes it. It's what makes it real. And steeping yourself in those details and allowing them, soaking them up. I would point out that this is really no different than historical novels, historical fiction, where you have a profusion of names and dates and peoples and places and usually gigantic casts of characters.
Right.
And there are people who are just as obsessive about that as people are about fantasy. And in fact, it's funny, I read Anna Karenina when I was in the middle of Aragon, had a huge impact on me. And when I read it, I actually had the thought that this is a bit like fantasy. It's writing about a world, the Russian aristocracy, that I have no experience with, that doesn't exist anymore, that... the book is translated from another language. It really has no connection with the world as it is now, but it's talking about underlying and archetypal human themes of love and faith and devotion and various other things. And you could apply the same criterion standards to fantasy. So I believe, as it's been said before, fantasy is a universal genre. It'll always be, and it always has been.
Yeah, Anna Karenina is something like an encyclopedia of love and marriage and stuff like that. It's interesting.
A depressing book. Good book, but depressing book.
1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina now. And Gabe, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi. Maybe this is a bit of a loaded question, but why do so many people, for instance, religious conservatives, feel threatened by fantasy, say like the Harry Potter books?
I wasn't actually aware that was there. My producer Tara is nodding at me through the glass, going, "Yeah, that's a part of it." What do you know about that, Gabe?
I know that there have been sort of book burnings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the magic, Christopher? That doesn't fit.
Yeah, I'm familiar with this. Unfortunately, this attention has not been directed at Aragon, not yet, at least. At least with Harry Potter, it's the fact that you have. Witchcraft and wizardry and forces of magic, which are perceived as evil by these groups, being taught to children. And this is, again, perceived as corrupting the youth. Of course, these charges aren't leveled at Tolkien, since he was quite religious and supposedly worked this in and did work this into his world.
C.S. Lewis escapes as well, then?
Well, C.S. Lewis was a close friend of Tolkien, and yes, he escapes as well, because his works are mainly Christian allegory. So, for me at least, I wasn't trying to write about our world. I was trying to tell a story in a completely imaginary world. But yes, I am aware of that with Harry Potter.
Now, Christopher, you're off to the UK sometime. What, next month, is it?
Next week.
Next week?
Yes, I'm going to be spending a week in Britain for the release of Aragon over there. I've never been overseas, so it will be an interesting trip.
Now, you just mentioned Harry Potter. Any plans for a rendezvous with J.K. Rowling there?
I believe that meeting J.K. Rowling is harder than meeting the Queen.
Yeah, you can tell her the same thing about you.
Well, I would certainly love to meet her. I think what she's done for children's literature and getting people to read is wonderful. I enjoyed her books, although I read the Harry Potter books after I had written Aragon. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the fourth book came out that I read them and devoured them once I had. But no, I certainly would love to meet her at some point.
Now, were you steeling yourself for a slightly rougher review from the hometown of J.K. Rowling? People go, well, what's this upstart boy from Montana?
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I know people certainly appreciate their fantasy in Britain, and I'm not sure what type of reception I get. But if it's anything like what it's been in the U.S., it should be wonderful.
Now, you've got another part two of a three-part series in the works, is that right, of the trilogy you're working on?
Right. Aragon's the first book, and Eldest...
Whoops. Have we lost the line there? You're back, right, Christopher?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. It was another one of those clicks on the line. So Eldest is the second one. How far along in that are you?
A bit over halfway. And then I'm not sure what the third book will be called, but that'll be coming out as soon as I can write it.
It's mapped out, though. You know what's going to happen?
That's right. One reason I was unable to complete the stories that I began before Aragon is because I didn't know what happened after the first five or six pages. I had the initial idea, but nothing beyond that. So before I began Aragon, I spent an entire month and plotted out all of Aragon and the two sequels. And it wasn't until I knew what happened in all three books that I finally sat down and put pen to paper. And I think that was part of the appeal for the publisher as well, that I hadn't just written the first book. I also knew what was going to happen in the next two.
Do you have any idea what's going to happen when you're 30?
Ooh. Well, I know that I want to get the trilogy done. That's the main goal in my life right now. Once that's done, I'll probably take a nice long break and we'll see. But I have many, many stories and books planned that I want to write. And, you know, there are other things I'd like to do with my life as well. So it'll be a mixture.
I suspect we'll talk again on this program at some point in the future.
I hope so.
Thanks so much for taking time to be with us. I know it's a long drive from home.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Christopher Paolini's author of Aragon, his debut fantasy book. Earlier in the program, we talked with Brian Atterbury, professor of English at Idaho State University. Our program's produced by Khalil Bird, Nancy Cohen, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karutsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.